for several months now, I've been reviewing the Four Foundations of Mindfulness discourse. And last week I was talking about what are called the five aggregates, part of what the fourth foundation of mindfulness, and it's the Buddhist version of a personality theory. The first aggregate is form, which is basically the physicality of life, seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and what it feels like to be inside a body. And then associated with that is feeling and perception. And they provide a bridging function between physicality and mentality, if you will. And then mind conditioners, all reflected in consciousness. I was going to go to the next category that's in the fourth foundation of mindfulness to review the awakening factors. But then I thought I really would be useful to talk about, I guess last week I talked about paticca-samuppada, dependent origination, which is really how the five aggregates operate, how the selfing process develops. And then I was going to talk about this week about the awakening factors, but then I decided that I should talk about the mind conditioning factors. So that's what we're doing. And for those of you who are here in the room, if you look up on the wall, you see the Chittasikas chart. And that's what we're going to be reviewing. And this is part one of that. And it's basically going to cover what are called the universals and the particulars. So let me put a little bit of context or background into this. This system of the mind conditioners did not really exist in the time of the Buddha. Over the centuries that followed the beginning of Buddhism, there developed a bunch of very large gatherings of renunciates who were scholars and practitioners. And they really wanted to understand, how does this selfing process operate? There was some terminology that came into being, and one of those terms was chittasikas. And basically that's interpreted as meaning those functions that operate within the mind. Conditioning factors, fabricators, lots of different terms can be used. So when we're thinking about human experience, there have to be three circumstances or conditions. One of them, there has to be some kind of physical stimulation. You know, you see, you hear, you smell, you taste, you feel sensations of being in a body. So that's one of the elements that has to be there. The other element has to be there is consciousness. Now, consciousness is kind of a mysterious thing. We're all experiencing it all the time, inherent to being alive. But in Buddhist psychology, consciousness only exists when it's reflecting that which arises in consciousness. So we've got these two elements, the physicality form and the consciousness. So in the middle are the chittasikas, feeling, perception, and the mind conditioning factors. And that's the third condition that's required. In terms of our subjectivity, those three elements are always operating. Now, the way they come together is what we're trying to understand here. So these scholar monks talked about it, studied, meditated, and they were trying to understand, how does this selfing process work? So they took this basic structure that the Buddha created, and they elaborated on it. It's a very interesting thing to consider, because this was before any kind of scientific institutions were developed. So all of this research was subjective. It required a very, very high degree of introspective awareness and objectivity, and has to be understandable. In other words, one person reports their experience to another, and because they're both really well informed in terms of the concepts and their own practice experience, they can kind of agree, yeah, this makes sense. This is how it works. Now, in contemporary world, we have science. Science does not rely on subjectivity. Science relies on technology for the most part. And we have these very sophisticated devices, functional MRI, EEG, so forth and so on, that can analyze to a very high degree what goes on in the brain in terms of neurochemistry and electrical energy. Very sophisticated understanding. It just so happens that a lot of what has been developed about understanding how consciousness operates, kind of categorically, validates what these scholastic monks talked about and developed thousands of years ago. Very interesting. It's one of the things I find most engaging about this. So this system of psychological understanding is called Abhidhamma. And basically Abhidhamma means kind of an overarching truth or teaching. And in terms of one major school of Buddhism, the Theravada school, it was compiled in a book called the Visuddhimagga, which translates as the Path of Purification. It was put together under the developed under the tutelage or the management of a monk named Buddhaghosa, around 500 of the Common Era. So this is almost 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. So you can see there was a lot of studying going on. Now, this system is pretty much intellectualized, kind of wonky. But so is, you know, modern physics and neurochemistry and so forth and so on. So why should we study it? In some ways, it's not really necessary. But I find it interesting because I'm an intellectual, but also because I think it provides a really good way to deconstruct the notion that there's an enduring self. Now, that's back to the issue about the brain. We know that the brain is processing neural stimulation multiple ways, multiple areas of the brain simultaneous. Visual perception, auditory perception, so forth and so on. All of these are happening simultaneously. And yet, here we are, we have a stream of consciousness that seems to hone in on one particular part of what's going on, this cascade of stimulation. The mind hones in on one particular part, just for a moment, kind of organizes it. That's what the aggregation is about, the five aggregates, and imposes meaning on it, what I call the selfing story, an internal narrative or critical analysis. And a fundamental part of this critical analysis is what in Eastern religious terms called duality. And what that amounts to is there's, you know, subjectively, we all have a sense of identity, a self, an observer, a witness, or a victim. That's another way to look at it. And that which is observed or witnessed, or that which victimizes. And so that duality is quite useful, obviously. Humanity's come a long way with it. There are certain limitations to what we can do with duality that are problematic. But the ultimate goal of all spiritual practice, but in this context we're talking about Buddhism, is to overcome duality. It's called non-dual. Could be called God consciousness, one with the will of Allah. All these different terms from different spiritual traditions have the same kind of application or understanding. So it's useful to understand these different functions. We have to understand Buddhist principles conceptually. We have to think about them. But then we have to make use of them to pay attention to how this selfing process actually operates. So that's what the Chittasika's system is meant to support, is that kind of investigation, to deconstruct the sense that there's an autonomous self. So you can imagine the Chittasika system, or the Chittasikas, there are basically 52 of them in the Theravada system. Imagine they're like file folders. So you have a folder and you have all these different documents within them. Imagine that the documents are what are called sankhara, mind conditioners. I've talked about sankhara before. Sankhara is a very complex term, principle, or concept. On one aspect, it is stored memory. In that way, it's kind of like a noun. It's there, it can be activated when the conditions are right. When it is activated, it's like a verb, and it actually creates a sense of self. And this creation is quite complex and multifactorial. So the sankhara are like the documents in the folders, which are the chittasikas. And each sankhara has a particular characteristic. For example, and this is just to illustrate how this file folder system operates, that there are any number of ways to categorize a dog. And you can break the dogs down into breeds, and some of them may be dogs that are friendly and other dogs that are hostile. And they all fit into the folder, and they all have their little files, but each one of the, their little documents, files, but each one of them has its own characteristic. So that's a way to understand how the Chitasika system operates. And when we create a self, different documents, different files are pulled out of different folders very rapidly, fraction of a second. These neural processes are activated. They come together to create a more or less coherent sense of subjectivity, a self, and also a sense of an other, that which is not a self, you know, what's outside of the self, or in many cases, something that the self reacts to because it's unpleasant, like pain, or it's pleasant, like pleasure. So that's an important thing to understand about Chitasikas. Now, there are several different folders of Chitasikas. First one is, it's not even really considered to be fully a Chitasika. It's a feeling and perception. I mentioned them when I talked about the five aggregates. Then there are the universals, which means that in every moment of self-formation, and there are several moments in a second. We also know this from contemporary neuropsychological research. There's this aggregates come together, collapse, come together, collapse multiple times a second, and kind of stream together and create a flow that's a sense of self. So the universals are always present. Then there are what are called the particulars, they're also sometimes called the occasionals. Particulars may or may not be present in any given moment. That's why they're called particulars or occasionals. Now, those categories are what are called ethically malleable. What I mean by that is they just create a structure of the self. That structure has no orientation toward either wholesomeness or unwholesomeness. But they're malleable because they co-occur with wholesome or unwholesome chitasikas, folders. So, universals, the particulars, the unwholesome chitasikas, and the wholesome chitasikas. There are a lot more wholesome chitasikas than there are unwholesome ones. Unfortunately, the default mode of the personality emerges from the unwholesome chitasikas. So, I'm going to be talking about the unwholesome chitasikas next week. And then I'm going to talk for probably a couple weeks about the wholesome chitasikas. And let me just say that when I get around to talking about the awakening factors, they are sort of the best application of the wholesome chitasikas. The awakening factors are really what promotes well-being. In order to promote the really develop the awakening factors, though, you have to set aside the unwholesome mind conditioners. Okay, so that's kind of an overview. Now, the other thing I want to say about Sankara, when Sankara is active, when it becomes a verb, that's what karma is. We talked about karma. Karma shapes our beliefs and our behaviors. That's its function. And so I just wanted to put that into the discussion. Now I'm going to talk about the universal, in particular, chittasikas. First, I'm going to talk about feeling. Now, feeling is really a key part of this whole process. There are five different varieties of feeling. There's pleasant physical feeling, unpleasant physical feeling, pleasant mental feeling, unpleasant mental feeling, and feeling that is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, neutral. Buddhism places a great emphasis on what's called mindfulness of feelings. Mindfulness of feelings is actually the second of the four foundations of mindfulness. And when I talked about dependent origination last week, the key function in terms of creating karma, creating a self, is the link between feeling and craving and clinging. When you can be presently aware of a feeling tone, and a feeling is a in modern terms, it's called an affect, A-F-F-E-C-T. And an affect is an instinctual, impulsive reaction to a stimulation. Where pleasant feeling is called affect approach, unpleasant feeling is called affect avoidance. So we are hardwired for that. All organisms are hardwired for that. Even little amoebas will wiggle their way toward a nutritive something in the environment, or wiggle away from a toxic element in the environment. So we are hardwired to be reactive. And what we want to do with our meditation practice is to be able to investigate feelings in a way that's non-reactive. A fellow named Jon Kabat-Zinn has been a really important teacher and author in contemporary Buddhism. He says this practice is learning how to respond rather than react. And he's talking about mindfulness of feelings. So feelings are with us all the time. They're universal. What we want to do is pay attention to the feelings. Also pay attention to the transient nature of feelings. Pleasant feelings arise, but if you pay really close attention to them, they are inconstant. The way they're inconstant is that the feeling tone of, I don't know, an itch or an ache, when you're not really looking closely at it, seems to be solid. But when you really look very closely at it, investigate it, you notice that that feeling changes. Very subtle ways, very quickly, like a buzz. When I walk around in the evening now, walk under the oak trees, I hear the cicadas chirping. And one of the things I enjoy doing is trying to pick up one little bug. And there are thousands up there. But I'm training the mind to notice the most subtle, to perceive the vibratory quality of that sound. So that's one way that feelings change. The other way feelings change is the kind of attention that we pay to it. The attention that we pay can either be sucked into the feeling, identified with it, this is who I am, this is how the world is, or the mind can alternatively simply observe it as a phenomena. And that changes. So what we want to do is pay attention to that transience. That's an important part of Buddhist practice, anicca, an observation of impermanence. So that's what feeling is. And feeling is a bridge between physicality and mentality. I mentioned that when I was talking about the five aggregates. It's also a bridge between one moment and the next. You can have a whole string of moments that are perceiving more about mentality, about thoughts, than they are about physicality. You're lost in thought. But there's still a feeling tone going on there. And it's still arising and passing away. Now, the other aspect of this bridge is perception. Perception is, I mentioned before that we are inundated with stimulation all the time. Mostly the stimulation that's associated with odor and flavor is not so evident. But visual and auditory and what's called somatosensory experience is with us. But when we're experiencing life, some of it becomes a primary focus while the rest of it becomes peripheral or even is ignored. The way it's described classically in Buddhism is that perception operates the way that a woodworker would construct something. Let's say that you're building a table. And there's one area where there's a gap between the boards. So what you do is you very carefully measure the dimensions of that gap, how wide it is and how long it is and how deep it is. Then you go find a piece of wood and measure it carefully so that it's the right length, the right width, and the right depth. And you put it down in place. Well, that's what perception is. Perception has this quality of marking the flow of experience. Some of it's perceptual. The perceptual process is physical, and a great deal of it is mental, cognitive. So in terms of Buddhism, feeling and perception do not inherently produce dukkha. Neither do the other universal chittasikas. But that's an important thing to understand. We may think of an unpleasant feeling as being bad. No, it's just unpleasant. That's all it is. But when it gets hooked up with the unwholesome chittasikas, it becomes dominant and becomes bad. And that's when distress and confusion takes over, dukkha. All right, now I'm going to talk about the other chittasikas. Contact, volition, concentration, vitality, and attention. Now remember, these are like file folders. Contact, it's a stimulation of the appropriate sensory tract. So the folder is contact. The documents inside it, the files in it, are eyes being stimulated by light, the auditory process being stimulated by sound, etc. Those are the different files in the folder. Within those files are different kinds of well, I'm going to save that for when there's just contact. What makes them different is the feeling, the perception, and when it's aligned either with wholesome or unwholesome memories, let's say. So contact is something we experience all the time. There's also contact in terms of thinking. One thought leads to another. So it doesn't have the same kind of connotation as light stimulating the optic nerve. It's more along the lines of neural stimulation shifting from one cluster of neuralized memory to another. Different clusters contacted, activated, stimulated. That's what contact is. Now remember, I'm describing these sequentially in a linear way, but these are all going on simultaneously. This is what I was talking about last week when I talked about dependent origination. I used the term contingent provisional emergence because that talks about it's all happening right now in a cluster, in aggregation. So the second, the next of the universals is volition or intentionality. The way it's described in Visuddhimagga, it's like a chief disciple or chief carpenter, etc., who fulfill their own and others' duties. So intention is what it's very closely aligned with perception. What it does is it starts to generate movement or instigate karmic activity. One of the things that I practice and I encourage other people to practice with their meditation is to be mindfully intentional about what you're paying attention to. Attention is another one of the universal chittasikas. So what I want to do, particularly when I'm just starting to meditate, is to intend to notice the very beginning of the in-breath. And then intend to continue to notice everything that happens during the in-breath. And then intend to notice the beginning of the out-breath, and then sustain that intentional investigation for the duration of the out-breath. Now, anytime we have a moment of self-organization, there's an intention there. Intention can be wholesome or unwholesome. When something pops up on the screen of awareness, there's an intention there. When I am not immediately alert to it and bring a quality of non-attachment, that intention can lead the mind astray. The mind can get lost in some kind of story. Mindfulness goes away, and the mind just falls into some sort of selfing story, right? So that's why it's really important to notice intention. Intention in its function is not simultaneous. It is coordinated with karma. They're synonymous. So what we're trying to do is pay attention to how the mind moves toward a particular kind of awareness. The next one is concentration, also called one-pointedness. I mentioned that these self-state organizations, they come together, kind of come to a peak moment, and then dissolve, and then are reorganized and dissolve. This happens multiple times a second. The example that I use over and over again, because it's so illustrative, is motion picture film. You know, there's just these still photographs on a long piece of celluloid. And when you put that strip into a projector, the right speed, the right focus, right lighting, they all blend together. Now, functionally, in a fraction of a second, one image flashes on the screen. That's what one-pointedness is. that one moment of organization in this context is not about an image in a projector reflected on a screen. It's about all these different chittasikas and sankharas coalescing, aggregating into a moment of subjectivity that falls apart, comes together again, falls apart, firms together again. Now, I mentioned that, you know, contemporary neuroscience can provide evidence that this is actually happening neurologically. But I can tell you from my own experience, and the mind develops a certain quality of alertness and detachment and quality of investigation. You can actually see those blips. It's like when you're in a dark room with a stroboscope flashing, you move your arm, it seems like there's a sequence of arms moving. Well, you can actually experience that subjectively when your mental condition is right. And I've had that experience, and it is remarkable, I can assure you. In Buddhist psychology, it's called arising and passing away. It's considered to be a stage in the process of awakening. So that's occurring. So this concentration is just simply the coalescence of these different functions in a momentary way. The next one is vitality. Vitality is just simply the aliveness of life. One of the ways to understand it is that we take in food and oxygen, and the body converts it into various glucose and various other elements, and that activates the neural pathways, the cellular functions in the muscles, et cetera, et cetera. That's what life is. That's what vitality is. But there's a quality of mental vividness that comes with every moment of life. The final one of the universals is attention. Pali term for it is manasikara. And what it boils down to is the ability to pay attention to what has coalesced. One of the ways it's described is facing whatever object is reflected in consciousness. When we're practicing insight, vipassana, it's called yoniso manasikara, wise attention. Yoniso, the word yoni is interpreted as the womb. Yoniso means that which comes into being, or the birth experience. So a moment of selfing is born with wisdom, wise attention. Unwise attention is called ayoniso manasikara. There's still a facing of what the mind has brought together, but it's distorted or afflicted with greed, hatred, or ignorance, and creates distress and confusion, dukkha. Okay, that's the universals. Now I want to talk about the particulars. And some of them are going to seem really familiar, but I want to explain why they're categorized in a different way than the universals. Moving attention to an object, sustaining attention, determination, energy, enthusiasm, and will to do. Now, they're called particulars because they may or may not appear in a moment of consciousness. And we want to be aware of that. One of the things that I enjoy doing when I go on my self-retreats particularly, but on other retreats as well, it's fun for me. It keeps my mind engaged. I'm not bored. I want to try to be aware of these different chitasikas as they occur. Be able to tag them. It's called noting. It's fun for me to do that. I have this printout of the chitasikas document, and it's out here all the time. So when I'm on a retreat, it's here for me to refer to, not while I'm meditating, but I just kind of look at it and I say, oh, you know, I want to pay attention to moving attention to an object. That's called vitaka. Many of you have heard me use this term many, many times. Vitaka is throwing attention at an object. The metaphor that's used in the Visuddhimagga is one would throw a bit of wet clay at a wall. In a trained mind, it becomes a crucial, in terms of supporting right concentration and the awakening factor called investigation of mental phenomena. So I also talked about intention. The intention to notice the very beginning of the in-breath, that's throwing awareness or focused attention at that first stimulus for the in-breath. What takes vitaka away, what causes it to kind of drop out of functioning, sloth and torpor, the hindrance of sloth and torpor. There's not enough energy for the mind to move to the object. So what is the antidote for that? Becoming aware of it and then intentionally targeting something, sensation of breathing, and focusing your attention on it. So that overcomes the dullness in the mind. It activates the mind. The next of the particulars is sustaining attention, and that's called vichara. So there's vitaka and vichara. I mentioned that throwing a piece of wet clay at the wall. If the wet clay is not wet enough, or you don't throw it with the right velocity, it'll bounce off the wall. If it's too wet, or you throw it too hard, it will splatter. But if you throw it, it has the right kind of viscosity, the right kind of wetness, and you throw it with the right kind of energy, it sticks to the wall. Right? So that's what vichara is. Aiming and sustaining. For those of you who've been with me all this time, now you have a clear idea of why I keep emphasizing how important vitaka and vichara is. It's closely associated with intention, and it is the precursor for investigation of mental phenomena. And mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and right effort are the first three of the seven awakening factors. Well, now you're understanding, hopefully, more about why I wanted to kind of sidetrack a little bit here and talk about these chitasikas before talk about the awakening factors, because they're constituted from these functions. So another way that you can consider vichara is that it rubs against an object. You can look at a piece of velvet, and it has a certain kind of characteristic. But when you touch it and you rub across it, if you just touch it, it has a different characteristic. But if you touch it and then rub against it, you realize that it has this texture to it. It's different than, I don't know, cotton. Right? So that's what we're talking about with vichara. One of the ways that vipassana was described to me many, many years ago, if you have a quarter and you have silly putty, put it on top of the quarter, it contacts the surface and then it oozes down around the quarter. You pick up the silly putty, you very carefully extract the coin, you've got a really good replica of that face of the coin embedded in the silly putty. That's what vipassana is. And you can see that it involves vitakka and vichara. Vitakka is the contact of the silly putty against the quarter, vichara is the oozing around. So the way vipassana was described to me years ago, the attention goes out to an object, wraps around it, picks up all the different elements of it, and comes back to the mind. Right? So that's what we're talking about with vitakka and vichara. Determination, also called resolution. It's a quality of conviction. Let me go back to vichara. What hinders it, what disables vichara, is sloth and torpor, also restlessness and worry. When a person is restless, when the mind is restless, there's no sticking to the object. Worrying, yes, there is sticking to it, but with the quality of restlessness, it's disabled, it's not functional. So determination, resolution. When it's associated with an unwholesome mind state, it's stubbornness. It's a kind of mental rigidity. It's disabled by skeptical doubt or by sloth and torpor. Skeptical doubt has this characteristic of indecisiveness, uncertainty, and a kind of inability to take action. The way it's described is it's like being at the fork of a road and not being able to decide which fork to go on. Right? That's skeptical doubt. So it's associated when it's operating at a high level, it's associated with the first on the list of wholesome chittaskas, confidence. The next one is energy. Now, energy shows up in several places in Buddhist conceptual structure. It also shows up as right effort. It also shows up as one of the awakening factors. But remember, these particulars are ethically malleable. So you can have a lot of energy that's involved with doing something unwholesome. Now, I mentioned vitality. Imagine that vitality is like raw energy, undifferentiated, or energy that's not channeled. So vitality is just this, like I said, it's glucose. Glucose has energy bound up in it. When it operates in a particular neural pathway or beating the heart muscle, then it's channeled. That's what energy is. So vitality is aliveness. Energy is channeled. Now the absence of it is sloth and torpor, dullness in the mind, lacking energy. It's one of the characteristics of the energy awakening factor is persistence, an ability to keep going at it. The next one's enthusiasm. This is a kind of a an engagement, an active interest. It's very much associated with the joy awakening factor and supports the investigation of mental phenomena awakening factor. Enthusiasm can be associated with unwholesomeness. A person can be very enthusiastic about destruction or hatred. But what we want to understand about enthusiasm is this quality of it's very closely associated with the next one, which is called will to do, zeal. So enthusiasm has a quality of heightened interest, engagement, and zeal is activated. It's once again, it's another way to talk about karma. Karma has this activating function. In fact, the literal translation of the term karma is action. And so that's what will to do is. You're putting it into play. Now remember, this goes on multiple times a second. So whatever comes up in the mind creates a sense of self. There are these qualities of enthusiasm and will to do. Now, what cancels out will to do is skeptical doubt, sloth, and torpor. So, these are the universal and particular mind conditioners. We now have some time for questions or comments. What do you think about this? You see how it might be useful that you could actually contemplate these factors, or does it seem too conceptual and intellectual? Yeah, Brian?
It's funny, as you were kind of talking about it, can hear myself. what popped in my mind was it'd be great to hear at least an example of how to use this, whether in meditation or in daily life, and then you did that. So thank you. I appreciate that, because it kind of grounds it a little more. Even if it's just like you say, it's just noting, just, oh, there's some zeal, there's some, I forget.
Enthusiasm.
Whatever. Yeah. Being able to just be mindful of those things. So thank you for giving those, even if it's just a type of example of how we can use that. So, because initially it's like, well, because I've definitely heard you give this talk before, every year, that sort of thing. And it's always interesting, but it's also, it seems very conceptual up until the point where you gave that simple kind of, just notice it. So, thank you.
Yeah, that's one of the problems that comes with the kind of developments that I described at the beginning. You've got an institution that is dedicated, it supports these scholastic monks. And so they're debating and debating and debating. If they're not meditating, if they're not trying to really see it, somebody had to see it. Somebody had to have a glimpse of, okay, this is what zeal is. This is the experience of zeal. If the person didn't have that knowing, the aha moment, I call it, then it's just intellectual and pedantic, and people get off in the weeds arguing about, for example, with the Christian monks, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, which always struck me as ludicrous, but somehow or other that was part of Christian monastic culture at one point, trying to understand, what are angels, what are their functions, how do you contemplate them? It just becomes useless intellectualizing. So yeah, it has to be validated by your practice experience. And of course, one of the best ways to do that is to, you know, dive in and go on a residential retreat. Like I mentioned before, that's one of the things I really enjoy doing on a retreat, is kind of picking up one of these and saying, okay, what is this? How does this work? So, other questions or comments? Yes, Joy.
When you were talking
Speak
about,
louder, please.
Yeah, when you were talking at the beginning about noticing what was happening as you're breathing in, breathing out, and I was meditating and everything was dark and there was this little white dot, and I thought, oh, neat, isn't that handy? I can just watch that, and of course it immediately went away.
Yeah.
And then the film thing, I was there. I saw those little films going.
Mm-hmm.
And it only happened once. But I get the concept about...
Yeah. It's what we call insight by inference. You have these singular events. I mentioned before, I had this notion of things popping, coming up and going away, coming up and going away really fast. By inference, I realized, yeah, this is going on all the time. My mind is not alert enough or investigative enough to notice it, but it's going on all the time. So that is a transformative experience, to realizing, oh, I read about it, this is true, this is how it really works, and it builds one's confidence, which is one of the wholesome chittasikas. Other questions or comments? All right, I guess that's enough conversation for the evening. Next week, I'm going to shift to the unwholesome mind conditioners. My inclination at this point is to cover all of them in one talk, but I may change my mind on that once I start to prepare the notes. So, as is our custom, let's sit for a moment together. Wish you well. I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.